and welcome to Go and Equip. I'm Shanda Lee.
And I'm Jen, and we are so glad that you found us.
Go and Equip was started to encourage and equip believers through stories from five specific themes. Ahava, which means love in action. Talmudim, which means being learners or disciples of Christ. Apologetics, which is defending our faith. Da'at Elohim, which means knowing God. And Besorah, which means good tidings. Words from Hebrew and Greek that you might not be familiar with, but have a big impact on our lives as believers.
Yes, and we are so glad that you've joined us for this journey.
Welcome to the podcast today. We are excited to introduce you to Bobby Conway and Tim Hull from The 1 Minute Apologist. Welcome, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be on.
Well, Jen, you have a backstory here with Tim. You want to share a little bit of that with
us? Yes. Years ago, Tim and I were actually in a small group together at Grace Church in Erie, Pennsylvania. And it's been many moons ago now, but we met each other then and got to know each other through that particular group, and which was a lot of fun, by the way.
It was.
And still have many friends from that group, even though it's been several years and we don't live in Erie anymore. But I got to know Tim then. And then recently, Shanda Lee, you sent me a link to the 1 Minute Apologist. It was a video, and I watched it, and I was saying, I think I know that guy. I know that guy. That's Tim. And so we, when talking about apologia, which is what we're discussing today, we thought it would be great to have Tim and Bobby on to discuss apologetics.
Absolutely.
Because this is their area of expertise. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about you guys, your family, what you do as day jobs. Bobby?
Well, I've been married for almost 25 years. I've got a, Heather's been my girl for 27 years. I've got a 22-year-old daughter who gets married in early August named Haley, a 20-year-old son, Dawson. And so my daughter, Haley, she's a gifted vocalist and just a fun-loving Christian. Our son, Dawson's pursuing acting and doing online Bible college degree. And the way that I got into apologetics and the way this all came about is I grew up in California. I was a big partier, never heard Jesus until I was 19, the gospel of Christ. And I had a friend who I played college baseball with take me to hear Greg Laurie. And I really resonated with the message, placed my faith in Christ, but I couldn't get free from the alcoholism in my life. And I kept struggling with relapses. And I eventually went to AA in 94 and would do over 400 meetings in the first year of sobriety, doing everything I could to get clean. And getting the alcohol out of my way just really helped me to kind of really feel free. And I started just wanting to tell everything that moved about Jesus. And so I was sharing Christ everywhere I went. My nickname at the Ritz-Carlton in Southern California became the Reverend. And I was getting in trouble because every car I'd pull up as a valet parker, I would turn it on to the Christian radio station and they would say, you got to knock that off. And I just was so burdened, ended up moving out to Arkansas, where my wife's from, and was doing a campus ministry where I go out and share Christ. And I kept getting stumped with questions that I didn't know the answer to. So that's how I got into apologetics. I was doing evangelism and people were asking me questions I didn't know the answer to. Those questions became my study guide. And the Holy Spirit began to really give me a passion for the importance of knowing how to defend the faith. So mine's a little bit different. It wasn't like I wanted to do apologetics because I intellectually loved the game of apologetics, so to speak. Rather, my heart was engaged in Great Commission living. And I felt as though it was a moral responsibility to know how to reach my brothers and future brothers and sisters for Christ. And so I felt like apologetic would be a good tool. And so that's a little bit of how I got into it.
Awesome.
That's great. Yes.
What about you, Tim?
Yeah. So I'm married 14 years, just celebrated 14 years recently with my wife, Jen. We have two kids, Maddox and Gretchen. Great. They're great, amazing kids. I love my family. And what I do for a day job is I'm associate pastor for Image Church, which Bobby's the lead pastor of. And then I'm also the executive producer for 1 Minute Apologist, our ministry. And then I have my own YouTube channel called Dealing with Deconstruction. Awesome. And my story is a similar in the sense where, you know, questions started to come up. But for me, those questions were kind of amplified by just dealing with a lot of emotional hurt from the church, being let go several times. Again, from my perspective, possibly unjustly, or, you know, in the major economic downturn in 2008, 2009, being let go because of budgetary constraints, and just feeling like that I was getting beat up by some church leaders and over and over and over again. And that started really for me to question, does Jesus see me the way that these church leaders do? Am I inadequate or unlovable in the eyes of Jesus as well? And so that set me on this journey to find out, really, to answer three major questions. What is the nature of truth? Does truth exist? Does God exist? And did God raise Jesus from the dead? And I felt like if I could settle those three questions, the other questions around who I was and my identity would be much easier to answer. And then that led me on, you know, several other rabbit trails, if you will, in the pursuit of those three questions. So that's how I started to kind of look at this endeavor of apologetics.
Awesome. So you guys mentioned, Bobby, you mentioned California and Arkansas. Where are you guys now?
We are in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Okay. Yeah. Not too awfully far from Chattanooga. A little bit of a drive, but not too
far. Is that where you guys are in Chattanooga?
We are. We're in Chattanooga.
Okay. Yeah, I fly in there sometimes because I speak for Summit Ministries in the summer.
Yeah.
And it used to be at Bryan College, right. And I forget where it's now at, but that's the airport to fly into. Yeah.
Awesome. Yes. My husband and I are alums of Bryan College.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Great.
Yeah,
that's I got my master's there.
About that.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. So, it's great to be a Bryan Lion.
So we like to ask a couple of questions at the beginning, just so our listeners can get to know you a little bit and get to know us a little bit more. So a couple of questions here. If you could plan an adventure for the day, what would you do?
That's a good question. If I could plan an adventure for the day, what would I do? You know, Tim, why don't you jump in while I think about the answer to that question? Because you know what I realized? I realized right when I jumped on the Zoom that you guys had sent some questions out. And I was like, well, you know, I'm pretty off the cuff, but typically I'm being asked more philosophical, apologetic, biblical questions. So I need to think about what a good adventure would look like. Why, Tim, he's more adventurous. He could answer that.
Yeah, I would say for me, it would be on the water somewhere. I love, you know, growing up in Erie, Pennsylvania, we were on the lake a lot. So I love hanging out on the lake or being in a boat or a jet ski or tubing or something like that. Or hanging out in, you know, we have an in-ground pool at our house now. So we love hanging out in the pool and just relaxing. One of the things that my daughter loves to do now is climb up on my shoulders and do some sort of mock cheerleading thing and then jump off into the pool. And those days are just so much fun. So we love to do those kind of adventures, just being in the water or being at a water park or on the lake or something like that.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So I guess for me, as far as an adventure, you know, what's crazy is I feel so blessed. I mean, I've been able to travel a lot around the world, a bunch. I've been able to see, you know, I think all but four or five of the states. And so in some ways, the travel piece isn't what energizes me a whole bunch. But I have been craving another trip to Israel. I've had the privilege of going there four times.
Yes.
I love going there. And it's been a while now, about a year and a half, and I'm finding myself craving being in some of those sacred spots. And so it's not a new adventure, but it's a nostalgic one that I want to get back to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would agree. I went in 2017 and I cannot wait to get to go back. It's just, it's that burning, like you said, a craving inside of you. You just, I can't wait.
It's epic.
It is. It really is.
I'm super jealous because I haven't had that adventure yet, but I'm looking forward to eventually getting there myself.
Yeah.
So,
you guys can go with us because I plan different trips and I'm hoping in about the next 12 to 18 months to lead another tour. So
oh, that'd be awesome.
Keep your eyes and ears open. We'd love to have you guys join us for a tour.
Absolutely. It'd be great.
Definitely. Tim, have you been to Israel?
I have not. I'm looking forward to going. I will admit I was a little jealous the last time that Bobby went. He got to go with several of our mutual friends and apologist folks. And I was like, man, that would be a really fun trip to go on. But yeah, I would love to go at some point. But
yeah, someday.
Yes,
someday.
Mm-hmm. We podcast that we released yesterday, the guest we were talking about being in Israel. And she just discovered she's 25% Jewish. Mm-hmm. And so we were talking about just going and being there. And I told my husband a few months ago that we should go and be docents at tourist spots, like mm-hmm. the Garden Tomb, and just be there for 3 months at a time and work there. I would just love that. We're
That'd almost be cool,
in
wouldn't it?
It would. We're almost in that next season. We have three college students, two of them living at home still. One of them, he's pretty much launched, but we're close. We're close to being empty nesters and being able to do that next thing of just seeing what God opens is fun. Jen, what about you for a daytime adventure?
I also love the water. I think I could see myself. I love to go out on the boat. You know, we do that. Our families go out on the boat once a year. And we look forward to that day every single
day. We rent a double decker pontoon boat. And so it's us and then another family. And there's 15 or 16 of us on the boat. So lots of kids and water slide on the boat. And just it's a fun day.
It's like that combination of family and friends and fun on the water. Yeah. It's just, I love that. That's, you know, nearly a perfect day for me. Yeah. So
shifting gears just a little bit here. Can you give us a good working definition of what apologetics is and what it isn't?
Just a working definition of apologetics.
Mm-hmm.
It comes from the Greek word apologia. So it means to give a defense. And so basically, you can be a Muslim apologist, a Buddhist apologist, you can be a Mormon apologist. A Christian apologist is one who gives a defense for why Christianity is defensible in light of the objections that are raised against it.
So what is it not?
Yeah, I would say it's not necessarily just arguing with everybody. And we'll talk about that maybe a little bit more here in a few minutes. But that's often, I think, what sometimes apologists get a bad reputation of, just being ones who like to argue with everybody. It can encompass this, but strictly speaking, it's not polemics. And polemics is being able to dismantle or give reasons why another worldview is not true. So it's, you know, kind of a positive case in that sense for Christianity, asking and answering deep questions, defending the Christian worldview.
Again, so what you mentioned, that a lot of apologists get a bad rap for just being argumentative, or that's the perception that a lot of people have. What's another misconception about apologetics that you guys have heard?
There's a lot going on in my brain. I mean, as it relates to answering some of the reasons why people aren't into apologetics, you would have, people just struggle with the tone that apologists come across with. Sometimes they're very arrogant or condescending, and that can be something that's really frustrating to people. Some people don't want to get into it because they feel like, oh, it's just simply a head game, and they're thinking, man, I don't like the academics of things. And so they feel more relationally wired. And so I think that we can show that apologetics isn't just for the head. I mean, even in 1 Peter, the whole idea of giving a defense was our life, right? Mm-hmm. When somebody asks for you to give the hope that you have, do this with gentleness and respect. Mm-hmm. And so I think that they, in 1 Peter, were struggling because they were suffering and they were struggling. And so, hey, when people ask you for how is it that you suffer so well, you know, be ready to give an answer. It wasn't when people ask you to give the ontological argument, or when they ask you to give the cosmological argument, or when they ask you to give the teleological argument. That's become what people identify or think of apologetics as. But honestly, in the scripture, it was very much about, in 1 Peter anyway, we can be apologetic in the way that we live our life when we suffer well.
Yeah, I would echo that. I think that's extremely important, that the questions come because of how we're living our lives, and that, you know, people look at us and say, what is going on there? And that causes them to start asking us some questions about how we're living and what we believe and why we live our life in that certain way. So I had mentioned earlier the idea of being argumentative. I was on kind of an interfaith council at a college when I was working as a college minister on Edinburgh campus up in Edinburgh, Pennsylvania. And I remember we were trying to figure out something to do for as a group for Easter, kind of running up to Easter. And my suggestion was, well, why don't we have a dialogue between, you know, maybe an atheist philosopher, perhaps maybe like a Jewish rabbi and a Christian. And immediately the idea was shot down across the board because everyone was like, oh, we're just going to come off as argumentative. We don't want to do that. And I was just like, I don't understand why we wouldn't want to put the best case forward, you know, for the Christian worldview, for Christianity being true, right on the edge of, you know, the resurrection celebration. So that was really head scratching to me. And I had to do some reflection and say, man, why do we have this perception that people aren't like, yeah, let's have that conversation. And I think it's because people felt like we'd come off as argumentative or arrogant or something like that. And so that was a difficult meeting, but it was enlightening in one sense as well.
I think there is there is that fine line that you walk as a Christian, sharing your worldview, and it is important to come at it from a winsome way to share your faith and to support the things that you believe with scripture, or to support the things you believe with sound arguments, for lack of a better word to say there, but. There's a way to do that in love, as you were reflecting on the First Peter passage. The culture is very opposed to that, like especially we see in social media and other areas where it feels like it's more attacking instead of often, anyway, not 100% of the time, but often it feels like attacks instead of taking a moment and really reasoning through what a question may be, or your perspective on something, instead of just, you know, going at it in an arguing way. So I think you have to be very, very aware and also very intentional about approaching topics with anyone about your faith in a way that's winsome and loving and respectful.
I'll add one more thing real quick. You know, Bobby mentioned earlier that when he was evangelizing on campus, that he was kind of faced with these questions, and that what kind of led him into trying to find answers for some of those. And in this a similar way, I think for me, conversation with people is really one of the things that drives this whole endeavor forward. I mean, apologists value truth. And sometimes for me, the journey of discovering truth is paved by conversations with others. Sometimes we agree with that person and we're trying to understand their view, more, because we said, man, I want to understand some of these pieces. And sometimes we disagree and we need to do that lovingly and try to persuade them through loving them well, but through conversation. And so, man, when I find a new idea, I want to take that and immediately have a conversation about it. Bobby, maybe you can speak to our little gathering that we had last week with some guys from our church, where we were just having a great time dialoguing around some questions.
Yeah, that was fun, Tim. We just had a men's night out and just try to extract from people some of the questions that we have. So, you know, starting a church, I've been trying to think about what is discipleship look like. Mm-hmm. And so instead of just kind of having a set program, one of the things that we want to do, and this is what we did the other night, is just have some guys get together and let's just connect for the first 30 minutes or so. And then let's just kind of ask the difficult questions that we struggle with in our faith, or let's ask the questions that culture is asking as it relates to their objections against Christianity, and let's dialogue about that. And so we were able to have a really good conversation. I do think it's important that people in the church have venues where they can learn to become spiritual conversationalists. And so they need to be able to have a place where they can practice talking out loud about what it is that they believe, so that when they go into the world and they're engaging in their neighborhoods or in their workplace, that they have had some time to discuss matters like this. And so I also think it's important when it comes to apologetics, and that we're discussing the right issues. And so that means for pastors in particular, they need to raise the awareness for their congregations on what are the apologetic issues of our day. Mm-hmm. There are these timeless questions like, where did we come from? What's the purpose of life? Did Jesus really rise from the grave? Is the Bible trustworthy? Why would a good God allow so much suffering in the world? What about those who've never heard about Jesus? Those are the kind of questions that have been around for a long time. But then there's emerging questions that we have to be ready to grapple with. And we have to understand what kind of a culture we live in. Mm-hmm. So in America, we live in a pluralistic culture. We live in a secular culture. We live in a so-called moral relativistic culture. But the irony is this, that it's not really relativistic as much as we would think, because there's a new moral code that has emerged. And that new moral code is this, that LGBTQ is morally right. And if you don't get on board, you're morally wrong. Mm-hmm. And abortion is right. And if you don't get on board, you're morally wrong. And divorce is good. And if you don't get on board, you're morally wrong. And so now today, in this weird flip, the only thing that needs saving is the church and Christians from the church. Mm-hmm. And the only ones that are immoral are the bigots inside the church. And so the new moral people are those are the ones that we say are in need of redemption. And if we're not aware of that as Christians and inside the church, we're going to be hard pressed as it relates to knowing how to equip the church and knowing how to help them to defend. And so for an example, we live in a culture that's very reductionistic as it relates to your identities reducible down to your sexual preferences. Yeah. And so of course people are going to feel like, you know, we're unloving if we don't accept what they believe their identity is, simply their sexual preferences. But as Christians, we're not reductionistic. We believe that people have a much bigger identity than just their sexual preferences. Their identity is that they're created in the image of God, that they're volitional, that they're moral, that they're rational, that they are male or female, but it's so much bigger. And if we can get people off of those type of conversations, this is where apologetics can be helpful. Let me offer you a broader identity, one that's not just reducible down to your sexual preferences. And so therefore that can help us to be more engaged in the conversation.
Mm-hmm. And so we're looking at conversations that we can use to begin to share gospel, but also with those that we've already shared with, how do you change that conversation to something to address identity or to address truth or address another area that they're questioning or that they're doubting? What would be a question that you would use to change the conversation, the direction of the conversation?
Me?
Mm-hmm.
I think that asking questions is good, that you bring that up.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm in a conversation with a non-believer and we're having a discussion, I do think that asking lots of questions will then hopefully get them to ask us some questions. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times what people think of when they think of the gospel is, here's heaven, here's hell. If you believe in Jesus, you'll go to heaven and you'll avoid hell. But the gospel is so much bigger. It's something to be lived now. It's an identity that we get. It's so much more. And so what we want people to understand in these conversations is that God, the gospel's for here, now, and forever. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know exactly what I would say, because it's intuitive for me what I end up saying in conversations. But one of the things that I remember, for an example, is I was having a conversation with a neighbor. And he was living with another man. And I bumped into him at the coffee shop. And I said to him, you know, one of the things that I really struggle with is when people want you to agree with them before you accept them. I said, I think Jesus accepted people even if he didn't agree with them. Mm. Well, that opened up a door for him, because he felt like I was telling him that, hey, I can accept you even though I don't agree with you. Mm-hmm. And see, we live in a time today where we're mandating that you agree with me in my homosexual or LGBTQ decisions. You agree with me or you don't accept me. Mm-hmm. And I think that we, if we can say something like, do you think it's possible for somebody to accept somebody, even if they don't agree with them? And I think that they would have to concede the point, because think about it. Don't even people in the LGBTQ community that do obviously accept each other, don't they have disagreements in other areas and still mm-hmm. accept each other?
Yeah.
Right. So of course they have disagreements in other areas. So why is it that we can have disagreements in other areas and still accept each other, but I have to completely agree with you in this area to show that I accept you? Mm-hmm. And I think that's another way that we can get at, hey, this is, see, the narrative has been so pitched today that we're bigots and we're hate mongers. And one of the things that I have been contending for a while now is that the church has been loved, shamed by the culture. And I started thinking about this a while ago, where I found myself going, I have never known a Christian that I would describe as hateful or bigoted toward the homosexual community. In fact, if anything, all the Christians I know would be 100% in agreement that, yes, we need to show love. But somehow or another, we've heard this narrative so much that I fear that we're just, yeah, we got to love, we got to love, we got to love. And we do. But now we think, because we've heard that if you don't agree with the LGBTQ community, then you're not loving. Mm-hmm. So what are our options? Our options are this. You either agree or get canceled.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to realize that this is the way thought leadership and apologetics can really help in the gospel, because even as it relates to the gospel, here's another point. In our culture, we have to realize that people need to share the gospel differently than they did 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, 20, 30 years ago, you were going door to door. You were doing door to door evangelism. Things have changed mm-hmm. so much so in our culture. There was a time when the culture shared the same values as the church.
Yeah.
So you would talk about things like divorce, homosexuality, abortion, drugs, all that kind of stuff, sexual immorality outside of marriage. All that stuff was agreed by the culture and the church. Now, the state has legalized the things that were once considered immorally wrong. And so now people aren't wanting to be identified as much in the church, because there's a clear moral chasm on our differences. Mm-hmm. And the way this works is like this. The moral trajectory, it goes, and I've defined it as follows: rejection, toleration, acceptance, celebration, rejection. Now, how does this look? Think about any of these issues: homosexuality, transgenderism, divorce. At one time, it was rejected by culture.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was tolerated. Then it was accepted. And heck, now it's celebrated.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't join the party, then you're rejected
mm-hmm.
for the very thing that they used to reject.
Yeah.
And so what does all that mean then as it relates to sharing the gospel? By having this awareness of the moral landscape that we are living in, what it can do is it can better attune us to how to dialogue with people. Because we also want to know, how do people perceive us as Christians? As bigoted, as hypocritical, as out of date. So what does this mean? If we go and start by sharing the gospel the way that we would 10, 20, 30 years ago, oh man, you need to be forgiven of your sin. People are thinking, what's sin?
Mm-hmm.
The government has legalized this thing.
Yeah.
You're presenting an outdated message. So it requires a rethinking then of how we can understand the presuppositions of those who live in our culture, and we can begin to dismantle them. And that begins by then showing, and I'm sorry I'm taking a little bit of time to answer
this,
but I really think I'm coming to land a plane now, because I think, so then how then do we do this? Well, we understand that people have been indoctrinated by a worldview, and most of them don't even understand the worldview that they're indoctrinated by, but they understand the slogans and the sayings, but they've embraced them uncritically. And so then this is where all of a sudden we can think about going back to people like Freud, Spencer. We can think about different poets that have been on the scenes in the past, like Blake and Shelley, and through their poetry and through Freud talking about sexual repression, and thinking about Nietzsche, who claimed that God is dead and you need to now, he talked about this idea of just finding your own identity. And now it's become your own will. And so through Freud, you see individualism, through sexual repression. So now we've been repressed. Through Nietzsche, we realize that, yes, we need to shape our own identity. We can't be repressed. The church has oppressed us. Through Darwin, we're given a naturalistic way to make sense of the world apart from God. And all of this stuff is coming together. And then Marx comes on the scene and everything is seen as oppressed and oppressor as it relates to finances. But then critical theory comes on the scene, and then critical race theory comes on the scene. And you have postmodernity, deconstructionism with Jacques Derrida and Michel Foucault in France. Well, guess what? I'm giving a lot of ideas just to say, if people will become informed about these types of thought streams, we will then know why we have bitten why we've swallowed the viewpoint that we live today uncritically, and how we can better do evangelism.
Yeah, that was great, and the way that you brought that all together, and you mentioned deconstructionism. You're mostly talking about the way we speak with non-believers and in that particular what you were describing just then. But we also are seeing the culture having a big effect on people that are in the church, in the sense that everywhere we look today, we see deconstruction stories. And so, Tim, I know this is something that you are versed in and interested in. Can you describe for our listeners what deconstructionism is? Just give us a definition of that.
Yeah, I think the way that I would define deconstruction, and again, I have a video on my channel about this, kind of going into some more detail, but I would define it as examining the beliefs of Christianity to see if they are true and essential. Some people go through this process and they conclude that they're no longer a Christian. Others, you know, reject just some of the core tenets of Christianity, and others are stronger in their faith and they have reconstructed. So really, in a sense, it's kind of examining those different pieces, for whatever reason. And sometimes it's an emotional trigger that causes that. Sometimes people are looking, again, as Bobby described, as they're kind of resisting the morality of the church. And so they're not understanding why the church is doing some things because they haven't examined critically why they believe what they believe. Sometimes it is just their own intellectual, grappling with things. And again, this is some of Bobby's story that maybe he can expand on as he wrote his book called Doubting Towards Faith. So I think there's several different, sparks that ignite the process of deconstruction. But in general, I would say it's the questioning of kind of core tenets and examining them.
Okay. And why is apologetics important when you talk with someone who is deconstructing? Bobby shared why it's important to why apologetics is important when talking with non-believers. Why is apologetics important when you talk with someone who's deconstructing or in that process?
Yeah, I think maybe I'll take a stab at it, and then Bobby, you can expand on it with a little bit more of your story. But I think one of the important things is just to know why we believe what we believe. I often think there's a miscommunication between what I'll call traditional Christianity and those that are deconstructing into something like progressive Christianity, between what we actually mean and why we believe what we believe, why we hold the belief that we do, and how that's then worked out. So I think there's a miscommunication often. So apologetics will help us understand expand more in depth about why we hold that view and why it might be related to another view. And that will then help, you know, spur on that conversation. So that's a lot of what I'm doing, particularly on my channel. I will give another plug for 1 Minute Apologist channel. We have several videos where we're talking about how to talk to a Mormon, how to talk to a Jehovah's Witness, how to talk to a progressive Christian, how to talk to a Buddhist. So we've gone through, we've looked at, first and foremost, we looked at the core tenets of Christianity, what we believe as Christians, what's essential to the faith as Christians. And then we've kind of weighed that against these other worldviews, these other religions, these other belief systems. And we've looked at what they believe, some of what their core tenets are about God, about, you know, where we came about, their view of the Old Testament and the New Testament, their view of Jesus. And so that's, again, another great conversation starter, is to kind of, you know, again, if you have a relationship with someone and it's, you feel like it could go that spiritual direction and kind of manage some of that spiritual tension, possibly, to say, you know, what do you believe about Jesus? How do you do with Jesus in your worldview? And just, again, start that dialogue with them. So I'll let Bobby kind of wrap that up with some of his story of doubt, and what came out of that was the book Doubting Towards Faith.
Yeah, that's good, Tim. And I would encourage people to subscribe to Tim's channel. It's a real passion of his, and I think it's a real niche. That 1 Minute Apologist, we kind of capture like tons of different topics, and that can be a great thing, but it can also shoot you in the foot a little bit, because we're not always just dealing with current events or a niche topic. And I think that Tim's channel is going to really look for those current deconstruction stories, and it's also going to be hitting that niche topic. And so people can really be aware of that. I think for me, you know, ladies, one of the things that happened, I ended up going through a horrific season of doubt, to the point where I had suicidal ideation. I ended up on antidepressants. It was horrific. And it wasn't because I was like your progressive Christian type, where I was celebrating doubts. I hated my doubts. Mm-hmm. And the reason I believe that I hated my doubts is because I loved my God so much, and it was so scary for me to think that I had been duped. Mm-hmm. And so I found myself literally agonizing big time, trying to figure out, why is my intimacy with Christ feeling so lost? And why is my head being barraged by all of these doubts? And I talk about, in my book, Doubting Toward Faith, the obsessive analyzer. And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of the people that are deconstructing a lot are obsessive analyzers. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by the obsessive analyzer is you could kind of have these OCD tendencies and obsess, but you might not be obsessing on, you know, the Christian faith. You might be locked into another area. You could be very analytical, and you might not be obsessive. But the person who's obsessively analyzing the Christian faith and can't unlock, that was me. I took my addiction, you know, got clean, and just started reading vociferously. I mean, literally did a 4-year master's degree in theology, did a doctorate of ministry degree, did a PhD in philosophy of religion. I was obsessed. I mean, my entire office at one time, everywhere you look was just books everywhere. And I was overwhelmed, because every book that I would read to chase down a particular doubt, well, I would learn about 10 other questions that I needed to chase down. Mm-hmm. And the snowball kept getting bigger and bigger, and I was getting crushed, and I had to renegotiate my faith stance. And so what Tim talks about, this reconstructing stage, I refer to that as just renegotiating my faith stance. Now, here's the deal. Some things need to be deconstructed. And here's what caused a lot of my doubts, and I think this is what happens to people. What are denominations? They're just different sized boxes that tell you how big or large Christianity is. And so what happens is, if you get saved and get put in a box that's too small, it can feel like it's strangling the person who's creative and analytical. And so what happened was, is I got put in a tight box. I went off to a Bible college in Conway, Arkansas. Didn't even know how to pick a Bible college. Central Baptist College. It was really legalistic. really black. And I mean, I was having to memorize for my evangelism class, 50 verses. I had to memorize in KJV. I didn't even understand Old English, for crying out loud. I was Southern California. I'm coming out there with my board shorts, my high top Vans, using words like dude and bro, and everybody's calling each other Brother Daryl and Brother Doug. And I was like, hey, that's just weird. Can just call me Bro Bobby. Right. And so I just didn't, it felt so foreign to me. And so I had to memorize, like, to my professor, I'm memorizing verses all the time, but why do I have to do KJV? The people that I'm witnessing to on this campus, they don't understand that language.
Right.
So I was being put in this box where, you know, I had one professor say, you need to be rebaptized probably because you weren't baptized into the Baptist Missionary Association.
Wow.
Well, I was finding myself very constrained by that. Mm-hmm. So I started thinking my way out of that box. And the thing that was great is I was able to realize that the box of Christianity is so much bigger than the box that some would want to put me in. Sadly, some people think that their only option is to embrace this tiny box or to walk away. And so what I'm passionate about is mere Christianity. And so I like to say it like this. Some people want to be as conservative as they can be about their conservatism. I want to be as liberal as I can be about my conservatism without slipping into heresy. Mm-hmm. Because when you're as conservative as you can be about your conservatism, then you're in your tight box are going to alienate others who are in. Mm-hmm. But when you're as liberal as you can be without slipping into heresy, then you'll conserve what we need to conserve and you'll welcome others. And I think a lot of people who slipped into progressive Christianity, who deconstructed into that, didn't realize that the box was bigger. And so part of our evangelism then, I think, would look like this. So for example, I'm not a theistic evolutionist. I'm an old earth creationist, but I'm not a theistic evolutionist. But suppose somebody was deconstructing and they were deeply committed to evolution. Well, what I would be quite comfortable doing is I would see this as not a gospel issue from the standpoint of, look, if my option was this person is going to totally deconstruct and they're going to go into progressive Christianity camp, I'd rather say, hey, you know what? There's some Christians who are actually theistic evolutionists and they ascribe to that view. It's not a view that I hold to, but I want you to become aware of BioLogos as a ministry and go check out some of the stuff that they're doing. Maybe that would be an option. So for me, I'm quite comfortable being able to say, here are different options for you so that you don't completely abandon mm-hmm. the faith, thinking that you have to go completely over to Darwinian evolution as an option.
Yeah. I love that illustration that you've given of the boxes, because so much in Christianity, especially in the South, it is very small and it is a very tight window or box of what you can do and can't do. And I love that view that Christianity is, the box of Christianity is so much bigger than that. Mm. And fighting our way out of those tiny boxes to exist and to thrive in the bigger box of Christianity is where we should be focusing.
Yeah. And when you really think about too, like a lot of the issues that we struggle with, the early church wasn't struggling with this. I mean, one of the things that helped me, doubts can be the making of an apologist. Mm-hmm. And so we have these doubts and we think about it and it can, you know, can develop, a person into a very apologetically minded individual. And a lot of this stuff, really, I had to wrestle through where I wasn't finding answers that were sufficient for me with maybe old guard apologists. Mm-hmm. Because old guard apologists were giving more your package answers to everything. And I just personally, I feel like I saw through some of that. Mm-hmm. And there's a newer breed of apologists that are developing right now that I think are much more intuitive and relational to the issues at hand. And I think that that's really important as we do Christian apologetics in our time. And I think for me, one of the things that was helpful was just learning how to think my way through some of these things that gave me answers that weren't packaged, that were really shaped for me, because my issues were unique to myself, some of them, some weren't, but the struggles that I had were overwhelming. Like I struggled relating to the ancient day world of the Bible. I would go to the Bible and sometimes I would hear Christians say, oh, you just need to read the Bible. Well, sometimes going and reading the Bible messed me up even more because I would see like Ezekiel laying on his side for 390 days playing with pots and pans. And that didn't make sense to me. And so I struggled relating to this ancient day milieu. So I had to kind of come together with an apologetic for the bizarre. Mm-hmm. How do I deal with the bizarre in the Bible? Mm-hmm. And so God would teach me how to work through that. And then I had to come really think through, what about those in other cultures that have never heard? Mm-hmm. Like it just became implausible to me that if you were born in a 1040 window, that you're just going to go to hell.
Yeah.
So I had to think through, like, how could somebody respond like they did under the old covenant by faith, and the gospel could be applied to them without that information piece? Mm-hmm. And I had to think through these types of things because the tight box really did set me up for doubt. And the other thing I would say that I did with my kids going through doubts that I would say maybe to your audience, I taught my kids, I said, I don't want you to commit to theological positions too quickly. Mm-hmm. You see what happens in the church a lot of times. Oh, you got saved at our midweek? Okay, well, come to our membership class on Sunday. And then you're at a membership class, and then you're signing on that you believe in the Trinity and inerrancy, that you believe in a pre-trib rapture, that you believe in young earth creationism. And I'm going, they're signing that. And what we're doing is we're setting them up for a future crisis of faith, mm-hmm. because we're committing them to things that they haven't even thought through.
Right.
And so we need a discipleship process that equips them before they sign off on this. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, like a lot of our issues today, you didn't even have the first book of the New Testament until probably about 16, 17 years after the resurrection of Christ. Mm-hmm. Jesus dies early 30s, maybe AD 48, 49, you get the first book of the New Testament. So we're killing people on, believe this, believe this, believe that. The early church was growing on loving God, loving people, celebrating the gospel. Mm-hmm. So I told my kids, here's what I want you to be committed to. Love God, love people, celebrate the gospel. That's great commandment, great commission living. Yeah. Then don't commit to positions prematurely. Study the different positions. And then after that, then you might commit to a position. Now, some would think, well, that's irresponsible as a dad. No, I felt like I was protecting them from committing prematurely to a pre-trib position and then reading a book on post-trib that blows up their pre-trib. And then when that process happens enough to an individual, they start thinking, I just can't trust anything. So I told my kids, you just need to know there's tons of interpretations about all these different views.
Yeah.
And just know that ahead of time. Well, now they're not panicking when they find out that there is, because I try to shelter them to only see one way.
Yeah. And when you bring it down to what's gospel, what is the gospel and what is the truth about the gospel, that's a much, much more focused discussion than pre-trib or mid-trib or, going into all the other things that are not the foundations of the faith, which I think is also important when you're dealing with kids, or because you mentioned, having these questions yourself can lead you into being a good apologist. Well, when your kids start throwing these questions at you, that can also cause you to become an apologist real quick. So, not that I've had that experience. Oh, yes, I have. So, anyway, so I think, but you're right. I mean, we need to be careful to go back to the gospel and to be clear on the gospel and what that is. And I love what you said there about the Great Commission and the Great Commandment, and those being the focus. That's very refreshing, and very
freeing.
It's freeing. Yeah. And it's the truth. That's the truth, which is I'm after the truth. That's what I want.
We have a tendency to get so bogged down with all of the options that are out there, everything that we're bombarded with, to make it that simple for people. Love God, love people, be gospel focused. Mm-hmm. It completely frees them from legalism, frees them from the boxes that modern Christianity wants to put on them, Western right. Christianity wants to put on them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm,
definitely.
Mm-hmm. Well said.
Well, guys, I think we're about out of time tonight. And I would just like to know, what's one thing that you guys would like to leave our listeners with about apologetics?
Tim, you go first.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I would like to leave your audience with is don't forget empathy, right? Mm-hmm. We should value truth delivered with grace. And as we enter into conversations with others, that should be something that we constantly keep in mind. Bobby has given several insights that I think are just priceless. We have over 1,000 videos on the 1 Minute Apologist YouTube channel. And I think the feeling that the essence of what Bobby just shared is exemplified in the channel. There's lots of perspectives. If you're struggling with the question, Bobby himself has done over 700 videos where he's answered questions in depth. We've brought on other scholars in different areas that have different perspectives. And it's a way that I think your audience can hopefully go through some of that catalog and be introduced to some of these different ideas. And then hopefully when they go out, they can empathize with the person they're speaking to. They can deliver that truth with grace and they can continue on in their journey. So that would be what I would want to leave your audience with.
Great. Thank you.
That's good, Tim. Yeah. You know, I think what I would want to share is I would never want anybody to be overwhelmed mm-hmm. by the apologetic task at hand. It is lofty. I mean, there's a lot of thinking to be done and there's lots of criticism that's out there. And I would just encourage Christians to stay strong, to realize that there are going to be objections coming our way and we're going to be painted in a negative light, and you can still have confidence that Christianity is mm-hmm. true. I mean, it all rises and falls on whether or not Jesus rose from the dead. Paul said that if he didn't yeah. rise from the grave, our faith is futile and we're still in our sins. Mm-hmm. And I think we've got amazing historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. And when I was in the midst of my doubts, I couldn't explain the resurrection away. And the objections that people come up with to try to explain it away are, in my opinion, worse. And it's much easier just to believe in the resurrection than it is mm-hmm. to believe in the objections that people raise to dismiss it. And so if Jesus rose from the grave, then he really did die. And if he really did die, he really did live. And when he really did live, he affirmed the Old Testament and he said there was more to come. Yes. And I'm confident that when Jesus comes in his second coming, that he'll validate that the New Testament came together in the same way that he validated that the Old Testament did in his first coming. And so just through the resurrection, I can get at that. And I would say, if you ever get bogged down with doubts, just go back to the resurrection. And if mm-hmm. Jesus rose from the dead, that settles it. And the last thing I would say is Alvin Plantinga is arguably the greatest Christian philosopher of our time. And he's known for reformed epistemology and properly basic beliefs. And one of the things that he shared is this great illustration. Suppose you are being convicted of a crime that you know you did not commit, and you're before a jury, and all the evidence looks like it's stacked against you, and it looks that you are guilty, but you know in your heart you did not commit the crime. You are still rational to believe in your innocence, even though the evidence looks stacked against you. Mm. And I would say that to the early Christian who's not equipped in apologetics, in your journey along the way, you might hear so many objections that it looks like you are guilty of believing in a falsity. And it looks like that the evidence is stacked against the Christian faith. Because the Holy Spirit dwells within us, we can be confident that Christianity is true, even though the critics want to say it is false. Mm-hmm. And you can trust God as you go on that journey, that in time, you will be able to articulate why it is that you are innocent. But just stay confident in God, even in those moments when you don't know the answers. Because listen, doubt is not a Christian problem. It's a human problem. Mm-hmm. In the absence of certainty, there'll always be room for doubt. The question is, which worldview best closes the doubt gap? And this is where I believe Christianity helps us the most. Atheists have doubts. Buddhists have doubts. The LGBTQ has doubts. People who go through sex change have doubts on whether they should have done it or not. And so this is where we are today. And we can stay confident that Christianity is true.
Thank you. Yes, great thank words you. To move forward
with. You bet,
with.
Chandali.
So tell me real quick, your websites and your YouTube channels.
Tim, what's our website?
1MinuteApologist.com. And you can find the YouTube channel, youtube.com/1MinuteApologist. And my specific YouTube channel is youtube.com/dealingwithdeconstruction.
Awesome. Yeah. Excellent. Thank you guys so much.
Yes.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies. You too.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today. To connect with us or for more information about today's theme, visit us at goandequip.com.
That's goandequip.com.
We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.